This is continuing the interview with Douglas first to now on August 10th, tape 13.
Forward, by the way, what's interesting, I think Forward's only degree was a BS in chemical engineering, but he, like Ernie Peters said, Forward really knew inorganic chemical reactions and was able to devise hydrometallurgical schemes for new processes in hydrometallurgy.
And you met Forward through him?
Oh yeah, but only after I had come here to Berkeley, and I went up to UBC and maybe gave seminars there 2-3 times through the years. And anyway, later on, Forward became the science minister of all Canada for about a 3-year period. And I remember running into him one time in that, when he had that role. So that gives you an idea of his stature. I remember Ernie saying that Forward got the Inco medal, which is a major medal in Canada, and he said it was it's 1 pound of platinum plus a 1 pound nickel replica, something like that. Anyway, coming back to carbide, there were... played bridge a lot in the winter at Niagara Falls. You can imagine that was one thing to do. And 8 of us played, this went on for 2 years, a duplicate bridge. And every other Wednesday, I think it was.
Who were the 8?
Well, one was Bill Krivsky, and I can't quite remember any of the others. What reminded me of that was that I was going to get back to carbide's treatment. But the first year, I'd only just played bridge for social bridge. And so the first year, I was probably reveling down sort of towards the bottom, because we kept a running score. Nothing was ever done with it, but where did you stand at the end of the year? Well, then I bought Gorham's big fat Bible of bridge, and I used to like lie in a bathtub and study a chapter like you're taking a course. And the interesting thing was the second year, I would try the finesses and all this and that and the other thing, and the second year, by doing, having actually studied this Bible, I was a person at the top of the list, and I couldn't do that anymore. We hardly played bridge, that one every other Wednesday, I think, and my wife still comments once in a while. Let's say when I was at our house, which would only happen say twice in the winter, it was coffee. Pot of coffee, and it was pretty quiet. I mean, it was it was serious stuff. No beer, anything but coffee, and of course, you're playing against the opposite table.
I've heard that that's the one game that doesn't really involve luck. It's only skill.
It's how you play. Compared to your counterpart who has to play the same hand at the other table. One hand I still remember was we lost because the other table had bid one club and our table, everybody passed.
Uh-oh.
It was, a lousy hand, and they bid their club and made it, and we went around the table and passed. So that's the only hand in the whole thing I remember. I don't remember the slams or anything else, but I still remember that one. But anyway, Bill Krivsky, now I remember the thing. Swan got moved to New York, and somebody named Red Shortsleeves, and I don't know what his first name was, became the research director. And Bill Krivsky was moved up to being group manager of that metallurgical group. And being carbide, they told him, you now can no longer socialize with your friends who are under you in the laboratory. And you know, I don't think Bill and his wife were part of the, no wives are in this duplicate thing.
Oh,
but we played bridge with them, I think, socially, and with Milt Stern and his wife, we sort of had known them at MIT. And when Krivsky got promoted, he was told, you don't socialize anymore with anybody underneath you. And it just pulled the door down cold. I guess I picked that up directly from Milt Stern said that that was, carbide lived in that kind of structured world. You do not socialize with people below you. And it was just...
It was told in right out.
Apparently, they were told outright what, how you should function.
Mm.
Hey, for some reason, by the way.
I shouldn't interrupt, but were you ever given any such instruction?
No, but they did have something which we called charm school. They started at the top, and this was something called Sales Analysis Institute from Chicago. You may have run out. That was a 2-week, all-day thing, and it must have been a minimum of 20 people from, now this was a corporate inside there in Niagara Falls, which would be both plant development labs and so on. And eventually it got down to my level, so I spent 2 weeks in this thing called Charm School, which was basically sort of how to sell, not sell by being a salesman, but it really helped in writing proposals and stuff. And you know, I never did finish the homework, so that I don't have a fancy diploma from the Sales Analysis Institute. But I do remember that when you write a sentence or say something, well, this is mainly oriented writing, I think, but and they had jargon for things, what's the good benefit? And I still remember, you always must put right up what's the good benefit so that the reader sees what's the benefit to that. To them in what you're asking for. And so I know that I've lived with that all these years, you know, and I forget what some of the other things they said, but I still remember the good benefit. You always want to tell people, let them know what they're going to get from it when you're trying to put something out. So, but they worked their way down, you know, this program may have gone on for three, 4 months maybe. In other words, taking 20 people a week. So they went, you know, through the organization there at Niagara Falls. I don't know, I don't suppose they got below this level of section leader, but we you know, had this teacher that, you know, from the Sales Analysis Institute in Chicago, and we had to, you know, write sentences that, they broke down everything into what, I suppose, the action part, and the, who's doing it, and what's the good benefit to whatever they call the receiver, and all this. I do remember, the only other person I remember that was in there at the time was somebody who'd been a Spitfire pilot in World War II. See, this is only 1957 about, so that's only 12 years after World War II, so somebody could have only been middle 30s and done that. And anyway, he said he'd been shot down 3 times as a during the Battle of Britain, and one of them he landed on a ship, an aircraft carrier somehow, and the others he ditched and was picked up, and boy, three times, and he still survived.
Ah.
Anyway,
I sort of diverted you. You were telling about your friend who was told he could no longer socialize.
Yeah, you know, somewhere along the line, just to show you how what kind of pay did it exist back then, and maybe Kripsky told me that.
You told me how Kripsky was spelled, and I can't.
K R I V S K Y.
All right.
W R W J Kripsky. Anyway,
okay.
Bill.
Thank you.
Anyway, maybe about the time I was leaving Carbide, he told me that his group manager, it's almost unbelievable, he was making $14,000 in red short sleeves as research director, was making $17,000, and now we're talking $58,000. So, which really, you know, today sounds incredibly low. For, you know, fairly, you know, large organization.
How much were you paying for rent?
When I left, I was making at 12.
Hmm?
But in 58, I was making 12. So,
how much were you paying in rent?
Oh, in rent. Probably not much more than $100. Dollars a month, probably.
Mm-hmm.
We bought a house the second year. First house we owned.
How much did you pay for your house?
I can still remember $19,300.
Okay.
It was a very nice tract, area in North, in Tonawanda, which is on the north side of Buffalo. A lot of people lived there that worked in the labs. I used to look forward to going home. That house was so pleasant. You know, not a huge place, but it was quite
nice.
Quite fine.
Can you find a house for $19,000 today that you'd like to go back to?
Why now? And how? But you know, another thing that Carbide had, okay, they had committees, like a titanium committee and maybe a few salt, I can't remember, but I know there was a titanium committee and a, well, maybe different committees that they set up to meet once a week maybe to talk about the progress and what was needed and what directions they were going and so on, and so it was obvious to me that the very top people in the laboratory, like the research director and the assistant director and so on, all day long would be or a lot of the days were in these committee meetings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was basically there was, you know, a handful that probably did nothing but, well, I was doing a little more, but that were every day, you know, in these, participating in these discussions of, mm-hmm. you know, what's of the research and technology involved in solving this problem or that problem, and probably go home and, boy, today was a busy day, you know. But they had two people that were very senior people, probably already in their 60s. One named Walter Crafts, C-R-A-F-T-S, who was a physical metallurgist, who had a lot of papers on stainless steel. And you know, Carbide developed a lot of the stainless steel alloys, but instead of going into the business of making them, they had a corporate decision. They were only going to sell the ferroalloys and not compete with their customers. So eventually, you know, probably around 1970 or something, carbide completely exited the ferroalloy business. But Walter Crafts, you'll see in the, say, 40s and 30s, a lot of papers with him. Then there's another guy, another person, Henry, and I can't, by the time we hit the end of the tape, maybe Aplin remembers his name. Henry, it was a Dutch name, had a little accent, knew everything about all, he'd been, decades at carbide, knew everything about their processing and so on. It was just, an encyclopedia of what went on. So at any meetings, these two people, were the encyclopedia of what carbide had done in the past, and what worked, and they were full, had ideas and so on. And so, the new young guys weren't out there reinventing the wheel, because they could tell you what had been done 30, 40, 20 years earlier. Whereas today, companies, such people don't exist in companies. They're retired at 55, and these people that have that long experience are gone. I think one will find that in any company, that the mining company, or I'll bet major chemical company, the same thing.
People don't stay for 40 years.
No, well, they're not. It's not by choice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people retire at 55 aren't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's passive retirement in my viewpoint. What we did is we looked at the different ore sources, and some of it reached pilot plant stage. Any ore samples that came in were sent up to this section, and people did. There was a very good scheme of how you can separate the minerals and determine what the ability, capability of making the separation. This is already put in place, and maybe my guess is Spedden may have done this, where you separate things by gravity and by electrostatics and magnetics, and you can now spread the minerals out and determine how effective you might be able to make the separation. So any ore that came in, this was done, and manganese ores was always a big thing. Looking for manganese sources of titanium were big during my time there. Rutile and ilmenite, which are still the sources of titanium.
Were these from carbide's own mines, or were
That was in the Union Carbide Mining, or it was not called Union Carbide Ore Corporation. Mm-hmm. That was an official name, not mining company, ore corporation. And they operated the mines. And there was Union Carbide Nuclear Company, ran the Uralan, out in the Colorado Plateau. And the nuclear company ran Bishop, the tungsten mine.
What company was that called?
Union Carbide Nuclear Company. This nuclear.
Right. And they had Bishop?
Yeah, they were running the Bishop. Mm-hmm. I suppose it was just organizationally.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Union Carbide Nuclear ran Oak Ridge, too. UC runs Los Alamos. Well, Oak Ridge was run by Union Carbide for many, many years. No longer. I think Martin Marietta runs them now. But all those decades, it was Union Carbide running Oak Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so all these companies were part of Union Carbide Corporation. The chief geologist of carbide, who I got to know a bit, was somebody who was quite well, very active in the AIME named Olaf Rove, R-O-V-E. And you'll see papers and stuff by him in the 50s, late 40s, and so on. So, you know, beach sands and for Rutil, I mean, they're doing a lot of exploration, I think, you know, Florida beaches, stuff like that. Columbium, tantalum, another metals that we worked on, you know, processes for treating these. They were looking always at new methods for producing the metal, and they had one whole section that used what is, one would call solid state reduction. You know, instead of melting it, smelting, you melt it. Can you do the same reaction without melting? You know, in other words, can you take an oxide and react it with carbon or with CO and at a temperature below melting, and now make the metal? And I remember they had a large, big program on processing, making chromium out of chromite. You know, carbide mined chromite in northern Rhodesia. You know, then came the, you know, after I'd long gone, you know, carbide couldn't import anything from Rhodesia, so, you know, whatever the country was, that Zimbabwe, I guess.
I think it's not Zimbabwe.
They sold the chromite to Russia. We bought the same chromite from Russia, the Rhodesian chromite from Russia, as I understand it, at, you know, a certain factor of two or three in the price. But we worked on this, and so we had this pilot plant to grind the chromite, and we looked at doing it with what was called a vibrating ball mill. Most ball mills, big round rotating cylinders that you've seen many times, you know, many feet in diameter, and a smaller scale one that never really took off in this country, but is, instead of rotating it, you shake it. You know, it's like taking a bottle of ketchup and you shake it. Well, the balls, you shake them back and forth, you can put intense energy in that small volume. And so it had a lot of pluses for it, but a lot of wear and stuff. So now these are developed in Germany, but Ellis Chalmers had built them here, but we had one that was like a 15-inch diameter, really quite a big, for that size mill, quite a big mill. And we had to grind something like 5 tons of chromite for these experiments. And I decided, well, got to do it, why not study the mechanisms and what's going on in the grinding action that takes place in these vibrating ball mills. And so I had these lab technicians and workers that were in the pilot plant do this in various ways, and then we made measurements on what happened at this feed rate and that feed rate and so on. And eventually I wrote a paper, and I actually did this purposely. There's an award in the AME called the Rossiter Raymond Award, which is for the best paper by an author under age 33. And you know, I actually set about to get that award, and I wrote this paper, which I think I called Retention Time in Vibratory Ball Milling, and it was published in the AIME. And you know, I completely forgot about it until, I think it was 1960, I got a November a nice letter that I was going to be the recipient of the Rossiter Raymond Award. And I actually set out to do it and did it and by figuring, well, we got to grind these 5 tons, let's learn something instead of just do it as a service. Another area that much work was done was manganese ore. And who's our, the small mine man from Reno? We did the oral history.
Oh, Hugh Engle?
Engle. You know, Engle did work for Carbide as a consultant. And his samples obviously would come, that's after me, mm-hmm. but Hugh Engle's would, he sent samples, and he was in Brazil and in Africa,
mm-hmm.
sent samples back, which obviously got to Niagara Falls, and probably Applin may have looked after him at that point.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
But manganese ores were a big thing. And Union Carbide put a huge effort in getting manganese ore sources because, you know, there is virtually none in this country.
Mm.
There was a little bit in Montana, as you know, from Hugh Engle at Phillipsburg. And I think during World War II, they looked at getting the manganese from those Chamberlain manganese nodules along the Missouri River, which I never saw them in place, but that's where manganese was such a tough thing in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And so Carbide spent a lot of time, and they had 2 reasons for it. One was making ferromanganese. And the other is, you know, dry cell batteries have manganese oxide in it and as a component of the battery. And Carbide, National Carbon, made Ever-Ready flashlight batteries. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you knew that Ever-Ready used to be Union Carbide.
Yeah, I associated Union Carbide with batteries.
Yeah, well, it was through National Carbon. The National Carbon also made the big carbon electrodes that were used in these
mm-hmm.
electric furnaces. And by the way, Carbide got its name. One thing I wanted to comment on was they produce calcium carbide. That's how Carbide got its start. Mm-hmm. And I suppose they took lime and reacted it in an electric furnace with carbon, and that made calcium carbide, and they started that around the turn of the century, and electricity from Niagara Falls was what they made these. They made calcium carbide. We're still producing it when I came to Niagara Falls in that mm-hmm. huge plant, and of course the calcium carbide that ran this, you know, acetylene lamps and
mm-hmm.
stuff, as you know, mix that with water and it generates acetylene. But anyway, sometimes one came out in the parking lot where all the cars were parked in the research lab, and they just coated it with white dust, and this white dust was calcium carbide.
Ooh.
And sometimes it rained, or maybe it's more, may have been more lime than calcium carbide. But if it rained, then came these reactions occurring. Your car during the day would get literally coated with this white powder, and you would never see any of that happen anywhere today, but that was 1956.
It was coming out of there.
Out of the stacks. Of
stacks.
This plant was big, probably several buildings wide and 3/4 mile long. You know, it's like as big as a steel plant, huge operation.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was the pollution. But they were, they had found that the best batteries could be made from ore they had in Ghana. And they had a mine there in Ghana. And the sad thing was that they were shipping the ore from Ghana up to Norway making ferromanganese. And it turns out that the crystal structure of this of this Ghana orb is almost unique in the world. And I'm not a geologist, but underneath the oxide ore was manganese carbonate, and when that carbonate got oxidized, it formed a certain crystal structure that was the most reactive in bad, you know, there's, you know, pyrolusite and selenolamine, and I I just don't remember anymore the names of some of these manganese minerals, but there are dozens of them almost, and it depends on impurities and the valence state of the manganese and so on. But it turns out that that deposit in Ghana was very unique, and I remember Rush Spedden telling me that in their, remember this is 57 about, that the geologists found, but not much of it, but a similar deposit in Brazil, at the Horn of Brazil, and of course what it was, it was the plates, and this was before plates, you know, plate tectonics kind of really came out in the 60s, and so just a comment that, you know, look, it shows you that Africa and Brazil, you know, were once hooked together at that spot. Uh-huh. And but anyway, Walt Zwicker and a couple other, there was somebody, two people whose job was doing the X-ray studies on, you know, alloys, metals, minerals. I mean, they ran the X-ray lab. And Zwicker worked with them and they with him. And on what is it, you know, in the, this Ghana, what mineral is it? And they discovered, finally, a new mineral, and which was a certain crystal form of MnO2, manganese dioxide, and which, you know, a lot of minerals are named after the the person, and some by themselves and some by others, and but they named this mineral ensutite.
Okay.
Yeah, they named the mineral ensutite and after Ensuta, which was a city or town where the of Ensuta, where the manganese mine was. And I remember Zwick saying it took them a year or two to go through whatever the World Mineralogical Society is to get, you know, get a, to, you know, for proof that this is a new mineral or unknown mineral, and get the name approved and all of its things. It's not that bang, here's a mineral, and I'm going to call it that. But they named it ensutite, and you can make. You can make electrolytic manganese dioxide where they take a manganese solution and electrochemically plate it out, you know, like you plate copper, but you plate out manganese dioxide. It has roughly the same, somewhat the same crystal structure, but that's a lot more expensive than the natural. But so a lot of the effort was directed, you know, towards manganese ores, and there was a geologist in New York named Virginia Mee, just M-E-E, and I never met her. I talked to her a lot on the phone, and all these samples would come in from her, you know, to coming into the geology department in New York, and eventually, I guess at some AIME meeting, Frank Applin introduced me to her. That's a, you know, I was no longer at Carbide, and then when I was here at Berkeley, maybe four, 4 years or something, she came by and visited me, she told me that, well, Olaf Rose suggested that maybe she ought to go back to graduate school, because in the New York office of the Union Carbide, you're never going to meet any young men. She decided, she applied, came and she got a entered graduate school here at Berkeley and in geology, and that fall took a look at all the incoming new PhD students and latched on to one, and she was telling me, you know, Roger really would like to get married. And I said, well, what the hell are you waiting for? Because she was no young kid. And she married this person, became a great giant in electric, in geochemistry.
What was his name?
What? Pardon me?
What was his name?
Roger Burns. Just digressing a little bit, he worked for me as a postdoc for a bit, for about almost a year. A postdoc while writing his thesis, so he's doing postdoc research, and I'll get back to that one. But he went to Cambridge. He was a New Zealander who had a degree in chemistry, did a PhD in geology here, then did a postdoc for 2 years in Cambridge, England, in Cambridge, and where he wanted to really learn petrology, petrography, and he really laid in on learning rocks and geology, mineralogy. Went back to New Zealand, and I remember he wrote me because I'd gotten to know him well, and he got permission and money from the university to buy some fairly expensive equipment, but the government wouldn't give a license to buy it. You know, this was when New Zealand was watching all their money, and there was an opening at Oxford, and they asked him to apply, and the day it closed, they offered him the lectureship at Oxford, and when Peg and I visited them, I think it was 68, and I think that was the year, she said, boy, it could have been a couple, 3 years later, but I think it was maybe six, oh, it was later, I think. Anyway, she said, I'm sitting now, Virginia, said, you know, Roger made more money as a postdoc for you than he's making here on the faculty at Oxford. Anyway, an opening, she told me that there was an opening in geochemistry at MIT, and I said, well, dude, Roger really ought to take that, and I urged him to apply for it, and he went there and became a big giant in geochemistry at MIT, and unfortunately, at age 53, just a handful of years ago, got stomach cancer and died. Mm-hmm. A real outstanding person, but just
very young.
Just bad. Maybe he's 54, but that's all. Mm-hmm. And just unfortunate set of circumstances, but. She was the geologist that sent all these samples in, I say, just with either a letter or a voice on the telephone. While Sven was still there, just tell you a little bit about, a couple times you asked about AME, because I assume you were always involved with AME, Wayne stuff, or not?
Well, not always, but
when you could.
Just about, yes.
Yeah.
Heard about it from infancy, surely.
Well, anyway, I'm going to tell you about, see, 57, yeah, it was every even year, it was in New York. 57, the meeting was in February in New Orleans, and so went to New Orleans, and I remember my roommate, the two of us stayed together in a hotel, probably with Ernie Peters, I must have been, because we were both working for Carbide then. And so we flew down there, and Ernie got an award for most outstanding piece of extractive metallurgy research for work that he did on that trail before he even went to Union Carbide, before he went back to graduate school. It was had to do with the slag from a lead smelter runs, and I'm working only off of my mind, 10-12% zinc maybe, and so you can put it in a rotary kiln and you can vaporize the zinc oxide. And so Trail put in a zinc vaporizing plant, and Ernie and worked out the thermodynamics of this, you know, how does temperature affect the rate and reaction, that's what the thermodynamics of chemistry is. And they wrote this paper on zinc fuming. It's called zinc fuming. That's what it. And he got this major, and then his co-authors who were at Trail, or I think one or two other people. Ernie had been a junior person there, so he got that award. There in New Orleans, and another incident took place at that New Orleans meeting I'd just like to tell you about. Dick Charles, who is a person who, R.J. Charles, who I shared a lab with, and you know, was now at GE, but the year he stayed at MIT, he worked out a, you might call a theory of comminution. You know, what's the relation between size and energy and grinding? I don't know whether I mentioned earlier that there was something that an Austrian named Riedinger, German Riedinger, the German would pronounce it, in English say Riedinger, R-I-T-T-I-N-G-E-R, said that the energy is proportional to the surface. And then somebody named Kick, a German, I think he was German, said, well, it's proportional to the volume of the particle. So there's always this argument, it was a Kick or Riedinger's law, that's all in the old books. And then Fred Bond from Alice Chalmers published a paper that he called, in a modest way, the third law of comminution. And it turns out that Alice Chalmers used this to design ball mills. And it's a kind of a straightforward, quite easy thing to do. Not necessarily too accurate, you can't do complex things, but it became the workhorse, still is, and they called it Bond Grindability Index and all this sort of thing. And it comes out that in an energy relationship, if it's proportional to the surface, you got a square, and if it's proportional to the volume, it's just got an exponent of one, and Bond gave it 1.5. See, it's kind of
in between.
He's in between, and it gave a kind of a square root relationship. But everybody, and Bond was a, and I'd met him, and, you know, then he must have been in his 50s, and published a lot of papers while at Alice Chalmers on comminution, on grinding, and they put it all into a number which they called the Bond Work Index. People still, to this day, use this. But Charles came up with the right thing. In recent years, after about the 60s, became very involved in using a little thing. What Charles showed was how this energy relates to the slope of the size distribution on a Jordan-Schumann plot, which then said that as the size distribution might be affected by the material, that would affect the energy. So he had written this paper, which I guess had already been published, and he was giving it orally at one of the sessions, and I happened to be there, and so just as Charles, whoever's the chairman of the meeting, introduced him, and he got up, just as he started to speak about, the room was a big room and was full of people, and a lot of them fairly senior people, which probably the one kind that wouldn't necessarily be at a technical session anyway. They all stood up and marched out. And they, obviously they were, it was a protest in relation to Bond. Because Charles was saying, hey, Bond's thing is wrong, not really right, which in other words, Charles is right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it turns out he is. But all these, I wouldn't use it today, but old timers, mm-hmm. They obviously, somebody planned the thing and stood up as like they were soldiers and marched out of the hall.
Oh.
So for a fairly young guy, it must have taken him back a bit, but it does make me wonder. You'd never see that today. Knowing the way people are, but for some reason they weren't going to let this young guy wasn't going to show up our old friend Fred Bond. We're talking maybe 200 people getting up and walking out. It was a big, as I remember, it was a big room. And
refusing to listen.
They wouldn't listen. Trying to make their statement, which was.
Now you said it wouldn't happen today. Why? What's the difference?
Maybe there have been more people working on a given topic than larger numbers of people doing research on a given area, so that there may be many, quite a few viewpoints and so on. Whereas in this case, research on crushing and grinding, there really, back in the 30s, was a lot of very good work in the Bureau of Mines by somebody named Gross, and his younger person then was somebody named Zimmerle, who's Applin may have mentioned. Zimmerle was the research director at Kennecott when Applin worked there. And Zimmerle, Gross and Zimmerle have some papers that are sort of foundation papers that were done Bureau of Mines work, really. And almost none academically, really, come to think of it, other than what Godin did in the early 20s, and then Godin never really got back under comminution, other than with somebody named Hookie. And so maybe in Bond, though, in the 30s and 40s and 50s had a lot of, it was the late 30s, let's say, and 40s was sort of Mr. Comminution. So I think, and here came this young guy saying, hey, all of this is not quite right. And not that it was said in a negative way, just said, here's the way it ought to be looked at, and we still say we use a Charles relationship or something to analyze it. But this spirited exit took place at that time.
This has nothing to do with comminution, but talking of changing times, I was at that same meeting in New Orleans, and it was my first really painful experience with Jim Crow. I'd had a previous experience in Washington, D.C., but in 45, trying to meet a black African-American college friend in Washington, D.C., and we couldn't eat together. But in 57, at that meeting in New Orleans, I was pregnant and went with Lang to that meeting and wanted to get on a streetcar to go from something to our hotel. And the front part of the streetcar was full and the back part was completely empty. And I was very uncomfortable and I wanted to sit down where there were lots of empty seats. And I was not allowed to sit there because it was reserved for black people. And I was really furious and also kind of ill about it. I wasn't feeling very good. And that's why I had left the meeting to go back to the hotel, because I wasn't feeling very good. And I was forced to stand.
Rather than
take a seat.
Did they have it sectioned off, or was it just
I don't think there was a physical section, but there was a conductor.
Or he wouldn't let you sit.
And he refused to let me sit down in those seats because I was white. And I was just about as angry as a person can be, you know, and it gave me a real feeling of that stupid, senseless, and how it hurt people. I wasn't hurt badly, but I was angered. And that was 57 in New Orleans.
I want to tell you about a trip with Kaiser a couple of years later, which was the same thing. But I remember now, I believe, because our plane went to Atlanta, and we had time in Atlanta. We went to that big panorama of Gettysburg Battle, I think it was, or what they have there in Atlanta, a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in the airport, I think it had restrooms, you know, white male, white,
mm-hmm.
colored male, white female, colored female,
mm-hmm.
you know, four right in a row, and first I'd ever seen
mm-hmm.
any of that. Then there, by the way, there was a, as I mentioned, Spedden, you see, he, you know, at least half my time in Kirby was there in Niagara Falls, and he was shipped to, went to Union Carbide Ore Company and was shipped to New York, but he was very active in the AIME, and then, as I think he was in the hierarchy, was called the Secretary Treasurer of the MBD, Minerals Beneficiation Division, so they had a newsletter that was published probably three times a year or four times a year, or a little newsletter of a dozen pages, maybe 8.5 by 11, that was sent out to the MBD members, and there was cartoons in there. I remember drawing some of the cartoons for this thing. And, but anyway, Spedden was involved with the reorganization of the Minerals Beneficiation Division, and so I ended up doing a fair amount of the discussion with him and the suggestions and so on, and I proposed that there be a what I called then a basic science session or committee, and that was the words we used then, which would have papers on fundamentals. You know, in other words, they have a committee structure, and the committee has like crushing and grinding, might be flotation or concentration. I think that's what they call it. And then they have papers related to that. There's maybe 8, 10, 9 committees, but what I thought was needed was a one where the fundamentals would be. And so that got established and was put into the system. And I, you know, dreamt up that we needed this. And then some few years later, I thought, well, that basic science, it's not science we're talking about. And we changed it. Maybe it's by to the fundamentals division, or not division, committee. So now it's called maybe just fundamentals committee or mineral processing fundamentals. It turns out that that fundamentals committee today may have almost as many sessions as all the rest added together. In other words, there's a lot of interest in it. And
it's really needed.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And I, at the time, I looked at it as a way to encourage younger people. And early on, I also said, well, you know, people in companies often are only able to go for a couple days to meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So why not have the fundamentals meetings always the first couple of days at minimum? Mm-hmm. And so that even got that way, because as I remember, even Carbide may have restricted how many days you might attend the meeting, because it costs money to be there
mm-hmm.
5 days versus 2 days, right?
Yeah.
And so I entered into that, and then another outgrowth of this was in 57, was the beginning of the planning for what was called the 50th anniversary of flotation, to have a symposium. And and a committee was set up, and I suppose Spedden in his role suggested that there was truly beyond this committee. And we met, remember flying out to Salt Lake City, so that would have been my very first trip to Salt Lake. And two people were really, I mean, there may have been 6 or 8 of us that met out there. And two people were spearheaded. I assume the person who got the idea was somebody who was a big man in the world of mineral processing, named Norman Weiss. Did you ever meet him, Norman Weiss, W-E-I-S-S? He I think, graduated MIT in metallurgy about 1922. I only knew he had been at MIT many years later, but he was, during the time I knew him, was, well, he'd worked, I guess, all over the world and whatnot, mm-hmm. but gold plants flotation was at AS&R,
mm-hmm.
and he was sort of like their chief corporate mill man. Call it that. And you know, somewhere I have a little book, it's probably packed away in a box, which is his own personal biography that he had published, and he sent me a copy of this book, which I read completely. You know, he's had a lot of years in Mexico and South America, and so anyway, somebody named Dick Vincent, who worked for him, and who I think was at, what's that mine in, I think Conger was there, something Bell?
Silver Bell.
Silver Bell,
mm.
In Arizona. And I think the person in charge of the mill may have been Dick Vincent. That was AS&R too.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that the person named chairman of the committee was Dick Vincent, and like I say, I'm assuming that the idea came from Weiss, and then he had somebody a little younger than him do this. I became chairman of the editorial committee. The first flotation plant in the U.S. was at Timber Butte in Montana, right outside of Butte, in 1911. So this was to be 1961 with a 4-year lead time. I took it upon myself that, well, let's publish a volume separate from the proceedings. And so I first proposed that X, Y, and Z be made members of the editorial committee, and I would have to look to see who they might be. Then I proposed that what we have is chapters in this volume on all these different subjects, ranging from fundamentals, plant practice, etc. And of course the committee all agreed that this would be nice, because this way they didn't have to do any work, right? So they all agreed, and then I went down the line and suggested that, well, why don't we ask ABC to be the authors of these various chapters. And everybody agreed and so on, and then I approached the various people and came this book, which if AME still had it in print today, it would be a very valuable book. In the front of it, for example, is a picture of a person taken by a person who worked in that first mill. And I think there's a page, his name was Pierre Hines, and you know, and damn it, I can't find that photograph. I must have used it. I mean, the photograph is in the book, but if you use a photograph from the book, then it gets the dots that you see if you reproduce it again. So we had this photograph that he took through the window, because that's all supposed to be a big secret, you know, in 1911.
Oh.
See? I guess. So anyway, what I did then is approach all these authors, and so that took quite a while to get these papers. But there's, you know, some on the very, very, very early part. But one of them I thought would be a good thing is just, how big is the chemical industry for flotation reagents? And I asked somebody named Merrill, and I don't know if there's any relation to the Merrill of cyanide or not, who was then head of the Division for Information in the Bureau of Mines in Washington, and he agreed, and so he and whoever his assistant was named Pennington made a great big survey form they sent out to all the flotation plants, and so they got the complete reagent usage of in the United States, in every single flotation plant there was, and then they're cataloged for the type of, you know, copper, lead, zinc, iron, and phosphate, and, you know, all of this. And later, somebody I knew at the American Cyanide Review, he jumped me as somebody I knew. He said, you know, that's terrible what you did, you know, to display our business like that. I said, I didn't do that, because I dreamt up the idea. The Bureau of Mines did that every 5 years after that.
Is it not been done
before? It really was, and I told the guy to make sure that one of those 5 years is put into the mm-hmm. into his the appendix of his oral history, that because it really, oh, it's excellent. But that was really that's where it all came from, and so there was a chapter in there, for example, on the thermodynamics of flotation, and one on non-metallic minerals that I asked Frank Applin. He and I wrote that. Another one I got somebody from Australia to write it on sulfides. We went all down the line, and one on statistical methods in testing, which was written by Bill Griffiths, who later became eventually head of Hecla before he retired. But he had done a lot of published papers on this application of statistics to mineral testing or something. Then an excellent paper was, I'm just telling you off the top of my head, an excellent paper was on sulfide plant flotation and